This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Once again, our guest is Michael Kellett, whom we interviewed last week. He's Executive Director of Restore the North Woods, whose mission is to restore the wildlands of the East, preserve and defend wildlife, wilderness, and public lands through advocacy, public awareness, and citizen activism. Michael's been with Restore for 26 years, after 6 years with the Glen Canyon Institute. So welcome, Michael. It's good to be talking with you again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Michael, Restore is an organization that opposes or tries to delimit deforestation in the New England states, right?
Well, deforestation as well as forest degradation, which is in fragmentation. So deforestation is where the forest is literally removed or wiped out or paved over. But you can also really harm the forest with logging, fragmenting it with roads or other things where it becomes little patches, and other, you know, things like burning, which are supposedly good for wildlife, but it isn't. So we see degradation as a big problem as well. And unfortunately, the forest industry doesn't see any problem. They think, oh, well, as long as it's not a Walmart parking lot, it's just fine. Everything's fine, even if it's been clear cut and herbicided and fragmented and so forth. So the only way to really prevent that is to have large areas that are fully protected, most of it in public ownership, although private conservation can also play a big role, but not in terms of the overall acreage. There's just no way it can do the job.
You told me that the Forest Service industry received a $30 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to promote climate-smart logging. What is climate smart logging, and what's your attitude toward it?
Well, I think it's an oxymoron. It's like clean coal. Logging is bad for the climate. That's all. All logging is bad for the climate. That doesn't mean we can never log, but let's not pretend that it's smart for the climate. It's you try to minimize the damage and also utilize the wood as carefully as possible. Don't waste, don't use it for stupid things that are not needed, and try to maintain the existing, for example, houses. Try to keep them as long as possible before you tear them down. Right now, the average house in the U.S. is about 50 years old, and then it gets torn down or seriously remodeled. And guess what happens to the old house? All this wood gets landfilled or burned. So that's not climate smart. So climate smart logging is a marketing term that was invented by, I don't know, the forest industry. And the $30 million grant was obtained by a group called New England Forestry Foundation, which is, it's just a forest industry lobby group. And, you know, they believe in logging. They want to increase logging. The chair of their board is a Weyerhaeuser heir, as of the Weyerhaeuser family that clear-cut their way across America to the West Coast. And what this money is going to be used for, they've hired a bunch of new staff, so they're going to be doing a lot of marketing to sell this idea that we need more logging. They also are really into building large wooden buildings, which is also a big thing, I guess, in Oregon. They call it mass timber, or CLT, cross-laminated timber. And it's basically just fancy plywood, but it allows them to use smaller trees, so they don't have to let the trees grow back as long. And it's a big scam. It's a boondoggle. It's not really viable unless it's subsidized, and they get, they use public subsidies. And but this $30 million, a lot of it's going to go to pay off timberland owners in Maine, mainly in Maine. So these big timber companies, they've got these large expanses of forest, and they've been overcutting, so the trees aren't, a lot of the trees aren't old enough to be viable economically viable to cut. And so they need money. And the other thing is, what they're doing is obviously not good for the climate. Even the New England Forestry Foundation admits that these short rotations, like 40-year rotations where the trees only get 40 years old and then they're cut, that's not good for the climate. So they're going, oh, okay, well, so let's have longer rotations between cutting trees, but, the timberland owners won't do it because it's not profitable in the short, because they want short-term profit. So we got the solution. Let's pay them. Let's pay them to not cut the forest as often. So that's literally what they want to do with a lot of this money, is just pay off these wealthy companies to not cut their forests. So it's a total scam, and there's no permanent protection. I mean, what a lot of this is within our proposed Maine Woods National Park. We'd be better off taking public money and putting it toward buying this land and then leave it alone. That's the most climate smart thing of all, is to leave the forest alone and let it grow back. So when you hear about climate smart forestry, it's a total scam. It's a fraud. There's no such thing.
So I assume that you rely on certain scientific sources to provide research on the condition of forested land. What are some of the sources that you use for your scientific research?
A good example is this Harvard Forest Study, which I mentioned, which was done this year, completed this year, where they did an exhaustive survey of all of New England, which is about 40 million acres. So it's a pretty good-sized area.
And was that done by Harvard University?
They sponsored it, so they had Harvard staff and faculty as well as some other scientific players. So yes, it's well documented, it's referenced, and so it's a credible report. So that's an importance. There are other studies and research that have been done. And so we have a pretty good idea of what's out there. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what the impact of the logging is, it's harder because the forest industry is well funded. It's like the fossil fuel industry. They've got tons of money. And they spend a lot of money spewing out propaganda. They have, as people are probably aware of land-grant colleges. Every state has at least one land-grant college. And those are colleges that they all have, pretty much all of them have a forestry department. And the ones in the West have a range management department. And those departments, with their money, a lot of their money comes from the U.S. Forest Service and other pro-forestry entities. So their faculty are totally on board, with some exceptions and those are people who are not very outspoken. They're totally on board. Logging, all the forests should be logged. It's good for forest health to log. All the fake stuff out there. Oh, it's good. Burning is great. And so we have to, you're not going to get good information from them. But this paper that I was a co-author of, I co-authored this paper, which was published in January in a peer-reviewed journal, and we did a deep dive into all the whole range of science that's out there. And we focused on the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, which goes down from Maryland, and then over to the Upper Great Lakes, northern Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and looked at what's going on in terms of the state of the forests and the history of the forests and what they're doing now to the forests. And, one of the biggest threats is this clearing forest that supposedly is good for wildlife, but it's not.
So the Harvard Forest Project wants to protect 10% of New England as designated permanent wildlands.
Right.
Is that a realistic projection? And how do you feel about that? That's their goal.
It's a very modest projection, and because as people may have heard, there's an international goal of protecting 30% of the planet. For biodiversity and climate and so forth, and that means really protected, like not carbon climate friendly logging or whatever, it means no logging, at least no industrial logging, no mining, no fracking, no ranching. In New England now, it's under 3%. So going to 10% is a big step forward, but it's, even that is very modest. It's only a third of the global goal. Now, New England is pretty heavily populated, so there are some challenges, but if we just protected all the public land in New England, the existing public land, it would be about 13%.
Ah.
So that is doable. Getting the 30% is tougher, but the Maine woods has vast areas with very few, with no towns. More than half of Maine is unorganized townships that have no towns, no public roads, no public infrastructure.
Wow.
They're basically like fiefdoms owned by these corporations.
Uh-huh.
So theoretically, you could create a 10 million acre wildland in restoration area in northern Maine, or even more. If a couple billionaires wanted to, they could buy up most of that land pretty cheaply, really.
Right.
So it is feasible. It's difficult. But it's politics. It's not that it's physically not feasible. It's that it's politically difficult.
What's the $50 billion wildfire plan that you told me about?
I think it's going through the U.S. Forest Service. There's an interagency fire program, but it also involves the Bureau of Land Management, but it's mainly the U.S. Forest Service. They've got a bunch of money that came, I think, from the infrastructure bill, and they've been spending years brainwashing people into thinking that fire is this horrible thing, and we've got to prevent these horrible big wildfires, and the way to do it is more logging and more thinning and burning. None of which have been shown to be actually effective in stopping or mitigating large wildfires. But they've, of course, there's a benefit, the economic benefit there. So, follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
They're using this, it's mainly going in the West because, as you're well aware, it's a big deal in California and other parts of the West that fire is, they've got everybody all scared now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it is a problem. There are people who live near fire prone areas. It is a threat.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the main solution is to help those people fireproof or at least reduce the threat to their homes of fire, not spending a bunch of money going out in the wildlands in the middle of nowhere and cutting down trees and having these prescribed burns, which don't do anything in terms of large-scale protection. But there's a lot of money to be had, so they're making money. So in the meantime, people's homes are burning down. And for a lot less, we could save a lot of homes, but they're not doing that.
What would the $50 billion be spent for?
It's mainly going to go to logging. They call it thinning, of course, but it's where you basically go out in the forest and you cut down about 80% of the trees, all the good stuff, and you leave scraggly remnant trees, and then what happens is when there's a fire, it burns through there anyway. It doesn't have any, it doesn't help. In fact, when you log, it opens the forest up. The forest gets warmer, it gets drier, it's windier because there's nothing to stop the wind anymore. Trees can blow down, so you've got dead trees on the ground. A bunch of weeds grow up pretty quickly, and they're very flammable. So it actually makes the fire threat worse. A good example is the Paradise, California fire, which was horrible and is famous to people who follow this. They had done thinning and burning and so forth in a bunch of timberland around the town. Supposedly this was going to prevent wildfire problems. Well, what happened is there was a wildfire, and it just zoomed right through all of those areas. And what happened is the threat was that it jumped from house to house in town. And so there are these photos, you've probably seen them, showing this, these devastated houses that look like they've been nuked. And then there are standing trees with green needles by the houses. So that shows how well it works to log the forest and so forth. So, but they're going to do it anyway. They don't care. You know, there's a whole industry now of logging for fire, of firefighting, which is it doesn't do any good. And then what happens to all the trees they cut down? Well, a lot of them are not worth anything. So guess what? They sell them for the biomass industry to burn them for energy, which immediately spews all that carbon out into the atmosphere and worsens climate change. So the whole thing is a big scam. It's a total waste of public money. It's not going to solve the problem. But that's what's going on right now.
There's a common belief that Indians, that is, indigenous people, managed large areas of the U.S. By burning it, by controlling, making control fires and treating the land that way.
Right.
You've taken issue with that.
Yes, they've used that argument in New England and the Northeast to argue, oh, well, they're not here anymore. At least they're not here in the numbers they were. So we have to replicate that burning and management. And the way to do it is to cut down trees or to do prescribed burns by going out and just lighting fires.
Right.
Well, the problem is that's not true. They didn't burn large areas. There's no evidence in New England at all that there was any burning of any sort other than accidental. Of course they had fires at their campsites and so forth, but there's no, and what they did is they reverse engineer the concept. They say, oh, well, we know they burn, so why would they burn? What reasons would they have for burning? Well, maybe it was to create more deer habitat. Maybe it was for herbs, and maybe it was so they just make up stuff. There have been some real studies that actually have done cores, for example, at the bottom of ponds to look at the layers of soil for going back thousands of years in some cases, and they can see whether there's been burning. They can see what kind of plants existed because of the pollen, and the experts who've done that, there's no evidence of any significant amount of burning of any sort in New England. New England, the forests don't burn. They just don't burn. Even in the West, though, there's no evidence that there was any large-scale deliberate burning by indigenous people. On the far West Coast in California and a few other places, there are some localized areas where they did burn. And it was to promote certain herbaceous plants and shrubs and whatever. But even that, it was a very small area in terms of the acreage. I mean, there weren't very many indigenous people. There were probably only about 6 million natives in 1600. There weren't very many. So how much damage could they do? They couldn't. They really, even if they wanted to burn everything, there weren't enough people around to do it.
Yeah.
And there was no reason to do it. So, and then you've got this huge area in the middle of the country where there was virtually nobody living in much of the area. Why would what would they be burning? Who would be burning and why would they burn? So there were lightning fires and they did exist and there were fires, but they were not started as any kind of plan by native people. There's no evidence that it's true. I've read a bunch of this stuff. I mean, what they do is they cite the same old studies, and then those studies basically are just speculative. It's all speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is they say, oh, well, Joe Blow, who traveled through the area and 1780, said he saw Indians burning, blah, blah, blah. So there you go. There's proof that they, well, you know, these weren't scientists. They had no idea. How do they know how the fire started? They had no idea. So the whole thing, but you think about it, what would be the benefit of making this argument? Well, if you really like to, if you think humans should be managing everything, that's, you can say, see, it's always been managed, so we should continue managing it. And the other bogus side of it is that this so-called burning and management was good for biodiversity and ecosystem. I've read this many times. This is another totally bogus. These ecosystems evolved over millions of years, or after the last radiation, 10, 15, 20,000 years, before there were any native people here at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all these species evolved before there were any humans around. So it's not like they need humans to manage for them. It's just really ridiculous. So it's sad that people... unless you really delve into it, it sounds sort of plausible. But that's not to say humans should never do anything and it's evil and so forth. But let's be realistic. When tribes are burning, doing this cultural burning in the West, it's agriculture.
Uh-huh.
It's agriculture. They're just doing it to raise, to create certain conditions that are beneficial to them. Well, that's fine if they want to do that on their land, but let's not pretend that that's natural or that that's beneficial to the ecosystem. It's not. And in fact, there have been studies that have looked at chaparral in California, and where they did do this burning of chaparral. Chaparral didn't develop common and regular fires every few years. The fires actually were relatively only happened for many, many decades, sometimes hundreds of years there wouldn't be a fire. And so if there's a regular burning like every few years, chaparral degrades into a grassland. And so actually this burning is not as bad for chaparral ecosystems. How is that a good thing?
Michael, I wanted to ask you about Restore. Do you just focus on New England, or do you work on in some of the contiguous states like New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey?
Well, we started out, originally we were focused on the North Woods. And the North Woods, there are various definitions, but what we were focused on was Maine to Minnesota and Nova Scotia to Manitoba in Canada. And because that's really all pretty ecologically similar. And then down south to parts of southern New England, even there are some northerly kind of ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is, of course, physically you couldn't do all of that. So, we did most of our focus on New England. But what happened is it turned out all the lessons we learned working on the Maine Woods and this new national park proposal, it soon turned out that we had learned a lot of lessons that were really useful for people in other areas, other parts of the country. And we'd compare notes, we'd talk to people. We knew that to get a national park in Maine, we have to get members of Congress from all over the country to vote for a bill. So we talked to groups around the country and said, gee, we'd really like to have your support for this park. And they'd go, geez, that sounds like a great idea. We have an area that might be a really good park. How'd you learn about this? How do you do it? What are the benefits? And so pretty soon we realized that we could really, we had a responsibility really to sort of help other groups and activists in other parts of the country if they wanted help. And so people kept asking us, well, where do you think, we go? Oh, there are lots of places that would qualify as national parks. And they go, well, where are they? What area? And so we said, I've been studying parks since the 1980s, and so I had a pretty good idea. But it became obvious that there would be a real benefit for someone to put together a vision, a national vision for new national parks all across the country. And as we talked to people, they said, wow, that would be really great. It would really help us. It would raise this issue, make it a national issue. So we developed this list of the top 100 new national parks. And that we've got that list. I've been assembling that for years. And we have a website where we're going to be releasing all of this to the broader public within, if not the end of this year, it'll be early next year. And we've networked with a bunch of the people and the groups who are working in these various areas, and we consult with them. We say, geez, you know, is there any way we can help, and so forth. A lot of people learned about our Maine Woods National Park proposal, and that inspired them to look at their own area and propose a park there. So it's like this feedback loop, a positive feedback loop. And here, people are hearing all this negative stuff all the time.
Uh-huh.
We hear doom and gloom. We hear about the loss of old growth forests. We hear about the, you know, gutting environmental regulations. We hear about climate change and so forth. Well, national parks are a positive thing. People love national parks. Whenever I talk to people about this idea, they go, oh, what a great idea. Something positive. We can support something that we can be in favor of rather than everything being negative. They're especially relevant because now, we've got these global crises of climate change and the loss of biodiversity. And also we know now that those have a huge impact on public health and well-being around the world. So expanding national parks addresses all those things. So what better thing to make a major focus than to spread the idea of national parks all across the country? And we've got the Maine Woods as a perfect example of how, if you don't give up, you can gradually make progress. We've got this national monument that happened, and we think we can expand on that. And so that's our long-term, and we can't do it all. We depend on networking with all these great groups out there. But we expect within the next year we're going to expand on this coalition and network and have a national campaign for new parks.
Well, give me once again the website.
Well, it's not up yet.
Oh.
What people can do, though, is they can go to the restore.org, and there's a little bit of information right now on new national parks. And when we have the new, there's going to be a separate new national parks website. It'll be newparks.org. But if you go there now, you have to have a password because it's not up yet.
All right, well, I'll pass it on.
But there will be a link on the restore.org website that will take you there. So if people are interested, what they can do is go to our restore website, and there's a new parks page already on there.
All right. Well, once again, we've run out of time, but this has been great. I really appreciate your talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
So thank you, Michael. Our guest today has been Michael Kellett, Executive Director of Restore the North Woods, based in Concord, Massachusetts. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com or kgvm.org and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.